ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Eating healthy is definitely something you intend to do, but when you look at the cost, it can feel like a full fruit bowl and veggie crisper is just out of reach. But a study suggests tweaking the way fruit and vegetables are prices are labelled could help you make better decisions about what to put in your shopping trolley. That is coming up in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, sorry, I can't make it tonight after all. Work's so crazy. I'm so tired. Are we flakier than we used to be, bailing on plans last minute more often? And if so, is that necessarily a bad thing? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, no matter how tightly held your neighbourhood is, there's almost definitely at least one empty home on your street or a long-time vacant lot in the area. And maybe each time you drive past, you wonder, what's going on there? Well, new research claims that the number of empty dwellings across Melbourne has risen dramatically from more than 27,000 in 2023 to nearly 32,000 in 2024. And across the country, experimental ABS data suggests that up to 140,000 dwellings are sitting vacant. So why would houses, apartments, and blocks of land be left sitting empty? And is there a way to utilise these properties to address our housing crisis? With me is Raina Fahey, the Director of Advocacy at Prosper Australia, and Dr. Michael Fotheringham, CEO of the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute. Raina, I might start with you. You're the group that's behind this Melbourne data. How did you actually figure out whether a property is empty or not?
Yeah, we started measuring what we call speculative vacancies a while ago now, and we use water use as our proxy for vacancy. So if a property is not using any water, we can assume that no one is living there.
That's fair enough. That makes sense. Do you know what some of the reasons are? Have you been able to dig into that?
No, and that's one of the questions that we really think needs to be answered, because there are multiple reasons why a property can be left vacant, and some of those are very valid. But what we don't know is all of the reasons why people keep property empty, and we don't know how long they get kept empty for. The data that we collect looks over a period of a year, but it doesn't tell us the trends of specific properties. So we don't know whether that property has been empty for just that year or for the last 20 years.
Yeah, I'm thinking on any given night around Australia, there's all sorts of places that are empty because people are on holidays or they've just sold a house and they've moved out, but they haven't moved in to their new one yet. How do you know what's maybe a holiday house or a long-term empty home? Can you speculate?
Well, no. Speculate's an interesting word. We do exclude some known holiday home areas from our data because we know that that's going to skew the results, and it's quite obvious by looking at it. But the questions around the reasons why people leave their homes vacant, we think are really critical to the part of the housing story. And it's not a part that's been told, and it's not really been investigated. So we know that there is, you know, an increasing financialization of our housing market, and there's an increasing amount of institutionalization of our housing market. So that means more companies are owning land as opposed to individuals. So we want to understand how that those shifting trends are influencing the way that our housing is being used, because it's interesting to talk about how many dwellings we have and how many new dwellings we have, but we also need to talk about what's happening to the dwellings we have now. Are they being lived in or not?
Well, your argument is that these empty homes are effectively wiping out one in every nine new dwellings being constructed in the state.
Well, in metropolitan Melbourne, our data doesn't extend past there because when you come to regional data, I mean, a lot of houses in the country just run off water tanks like mine. Mm. So that data's less than accurate. And our other concern is that vacancy is increasingly concentrated in specific areas. The top three local government areas in our latest data update, it was 1 in 3, not 1 in 9. So, 1 in 34 dwellings were completely empty. So that equals about 1 in 3 new houses added into those areas is effectively being left vacant.
What are you calling for? Like, what's the implications of this data that you've been able to quantify?
Great question. So two things. Firstly, we want the government to be collecting this data. We're a tiny little funded by donors, little not-for-profit in Melbourne, and we think this is a really important story that should be being told by the government. So we would like to see the ABS invest in collecting this data on a nationwide level and figuring out how to do that, because it is quite tricky. But secondly, we want to see tax reform. We want to see taxes shifted off production and work and onto land and natural resources and, to try and curb speculation within these markets.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Raina Fahey from Prosper Australia about new data that organisations released showing an increase in the number of empty dwellings around Melbourne, maybe indicative of a trend more broadly in Australia. One person says, thank you for discussing these 32,000 empty houses in Melbourne. It's an important part of the picture of the housing crisis. Another says, as long as people can benefit through negative gearing from running a property at a loss, we will continue to have unoccupied properties. We need to shift tax incentives from negative gearing to providing long-term secure rentals. Another says, I live in Torquay, a beachside town. It's a mix of permanent homes and holiday houses. The staff for the cafes and shops struggle to find housing. We have young people live with us, which we love, but their mates pay huge rents and are often tipped out for Airbnbs. Well, also with me is Dr. Michael Fotheringham from the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute. Michael, what do you make of these figures from Prosper Australia?
Oh, I think they're a really interesting insight on a really challenging phenomenon. You know, we know that there are many houses, many homes in Australia that are vacant, some of them short term, some of them for longer term, but we don't have good reliable data on that longer term picture, nor do we have a national picture of what this looks like. So the work Prosper's done, you know, in Melbourne is a useful contribution, but I think we do need to have a more systematic approach to this to really actually understand what's happening across the country.
It's interesting that we don't really have a good way of counting this. I mean, water usage is really interesting, but I'm thinking of back in 2022, the last census figures came out, and there was a story then about Australia's 1 million vacant houses, but that was a bit of a misnomer.
Well, yeah, it absolutely was. I mean, you know, on census night in 2021, there were also a lot of people staying in hotels. There were a whole lot of factors that had people moving around on that one point in time. And so, you know, there was an interesting discussion at that point about what does this mean, you know, for our country? How many of our homes are actually empty long term? But, you know, Australia's unusual. We don't actually record this in a systematic way. We don't have regular government data for this. Uhuru's putting out a report tomorrow, actually, so I'm going to be careful about our embargo. But we've got a report coming out tomorrow looking at how do we account for vacancy, particularly in our rental systems, because most of the reporting of vacant homes in Australia just talks about homes that are available to rent. So what are the current rental listings that real estate agents have that are available right now? And it's done through three different data platforms, but all of them commercially run, you know, none of them government run. And that's quite unusual as a nation.
Is it a sign of a systemic problem if houses are sitting vacant, Michael?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's inefficient in terms of use of the stock we have. It's been a lot of discussion, you know, in politics and media about the need for more housing supply. If a proportion of that is just unused, then yeah, that is a problem. What we don't know is why it's being unused and for how long. So, you know, for some, you know, there are some really valid reasons that homes can be empty for a period of time. Someone might have a, you know, have had a serious surgery and need rehabilitation and therefore not be in the home for a month or two, or they could be travelling, or, you know, there are a whole lot of reasons. Properties are waiting for redevelopment as a site, looking to get a building approval, all sorts of reasons. But there are some that are just being land banked, and we don't know how many.
There's lots of suggestions coming through on the text line of what we could be doing with the vacant homes and blocks of land in the neighbourhoods that you're listening from. Janet says renting out empty properties if the owner in aged care often creates a financial disadvantage with pension, etc. An interesting point. Sally says, aren't there historical records of water usage? That would show when the property was last occupied. Great topic. I hate that houses for holiday rentals are empty most of the time and kill the community spirit as their numbers grow. Similarly, Sue in Lennox Head says, in our small lane and the streets nearby, I would estimate that approximately one quarter of properties sit vacant for most of the year, eroding community. And Prem says, I live in Bega on the far south coast of New South Wales. There are numerous vacant public buildings around the town. Opposite me is a stunning vacant old heritage stone building that's constantly being vandalised. This could be an education centre or a vegetable growing space. The entire old Bega Hospital remains standing untouched at least 8 years after building the new hospital. This could be converted to accommodation or any number of community spaces. There's a brilliant old grandstand and club building overlooking the old race course. I'd imagine this could be a fantastic outdoor cinema and performance space. Local councils and developers lack the vision. Michael, are we doing enough to utilise these spaces that we have in communities like Bega and the other places we've mentioned?
It's a great question. I mean, I think that adaptive reuse of taking existing buildings, not necessarily just homes, but other types of buildings, and reusing them in new ways that are more appropriate for the community, whether that be converted into housing or used in it as a community facility of a different type, is a terrific thing to do. It's more efficient environmentally than knocking down and building a new thing, and it's faster. So, you know, there's a lot of advantages to that. It's not always easy because, you know, there are zoning issues, there are safety issues, you know, with particularly older buildings. But it's certainly something we should be alive to.
Raina, what would you like to see done with the data that you've gathered, and how could we build on it?
We want to increase the conversations that we're having with various housing ministers and revenue ministers, because it sort of sits within both of their portfolios. We'd really like to see the data taken off our hands and expanded, and we're really interested in trying to get much more granular data in terms of length of vacancy and consolidation of asset portfolios. So we want to understand, you know, I mean, how much of that land is owned by government? How much of it is land is owned by institution, not-for-profit institutions? How much of it is owned by companies? We need to understand that data at a much greater level so that we can make some really informed decisions about what to do about the problem.
What kind of informed decisions would you envisage happening?
Well, when it comes to, say, government land, I mean, you know, there are other countries in the world where you can get a list of, by department, how many houses each department has empty, and then the department knows, if I've got 10 houses empty, well, what can I do with it? The rest of the department knows what to do with it. If you talk to local government in Victoria and you ask them, how much empty land have you got, they generally can't give you an answer. So they've got a resource there that's not being utilised. We'd love to see that conversation shift.
So staying with Victoria for a second, Michael, the Victorian government introduced a vacant residential land tax in 2018. It's going to be expanded on January 1st, so coming up pretty soon. Are measures like that one of the ways we can address unused housing?
Well, they can help to a degree. I mean, I think the jury's still out on how effective that tax has been. You know, compared to the cost of a property, it's a fairly small, effectively administrative fee for a property being empty. And there's a danger there of it being a hit on people who are struggling financially in other ways. And the cause of the vacancy might actually be quite legitimate and not something that should be punished. So it's tricky to work through. There's nuance there to work through. But what we need to do, and I think Raina's exactly right, is we need better data on this. We need to understand this better. You know, we'd like to see this being government supplied data. You know, this should be core administrative data. We're making housing policy decisions based on, you know, incomplete data sets, either from you know, the good work Prosper's doing, or from commercially run data sets, you know, run by real estate agents. And that shouldn't be the basis for our decision making.
Well, Raina, Michael, thank you both so much for joining me. Raina Fahey is Director of Advocacy at Prosper Australia. Dr. Michael Fotheringham is the CEO of the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, which does have a report coming out tomorrow looking at rental vacancies. Michael wasn't able to give us too much of a preview now, but we'll look out for that in the next day or two. And thank you for your texts as well. It's been really interesting getting your perspectives on why places are empty. One person says it might be useful to distinguish between empty of people and empty of stuff. In my personal experience, things can change a lot when you suddenly need to care for a loved one. My home has been essentially empty of people for a couple of years because I haven't had a chance to clean it out, to rent it out while caring for my mum. Very similar story from VJ saying, my mum has been in aged care for 2 years. Her house is still vacant because for the 50 years she lived there, they kept everything for a rainy day. Historic family records are amongst the belongings. Between my work and looking after her, I've had no time to clear out the house and find and sort the family history. So it's still vacant. She would love to go home but can't find enough care. Pip says, let's legalise squatting in any property that's left vacant for more than, say, 6 weeks. That would reduce the financial incentives. I love this anarchistic approach from you, Pip. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Up next, fruit and veggies can feel expensive, but what if that's just a perception problem?
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Dear Jane, on The Book Show Mondays at 10 on ABC Radio National or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Only around 1 in 20 Australians eat enough fruit and veggies. That's right, 5%. The rest of us are falling way short of what the evidence shows is best for us. And honestly, you can understand it. When you look at the prices of fresh produce in the shop, it's easy to hesitate because that cost per kilo can feel like you need to take out a second mortgage to fill your fruit bowl. But is it really that expensive? A Monash study has looked at our perception of prices of fresh produce and found that displaying a cost per serving on the ticket led shoppers to buy more vegetables. I will unpick why this works in a second. With me is Associate Professor Fiona Newton, who's a consumer psychology expert at Monash. She led the study. It saw shoppers at selected IGA stores bought more veggies when the tags displayed cost per serving instead of cost per kilo. Fiona, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me.
I've tried to distill your findings, but tell me a bit about what you looked at.
Okay, it started with the exact thing that you've just said. People look at the sticker and they get sticker shock. Mm. So what this is about is debundling how many nutritional serves are in a kilo of veg, and it's 13 serves. So let's take zucchinis as an example. If you see a pricing ticket at the moment in normal retail environments, it's $7.99 per kilo. Yeah. What we've done is we've said, it's only 60 cents per nutritional serve. So nutritional serve pricing is just a simple addition to supermarket tickets. It shows the cost in addition to the per kilo price of one nutritional serve of veg or fruit.
It can be even more confusing depending on where you shop, because sometimes this veg is price per kilo, this is price per unit. It might be $4 for a half a head of cauliflower or something. I'm like, I don't know if that's good value or not.
And that's the problem. It's abstracted out from what we eat. And so what we've done with nutritional per serve pricing is to say this is the consumption cost of a single nutritional serve. And in the environment, in the supermarket environment, you also see, and you need 2 and 5 of these. So 2 of fruit and 5 serves of veg per day. That's the recommended amount. And so it gives shoppers a clearer sense of value. And a simpler way to assess what veg fits within their budget, because carrots at $2.99 a kilo come down to just 22 cents per nutritional serve. So they might want to double down and have two serves of carrots and then a serve of zucchini, and they would still be just around that dollar value for three serves of veg. So it helps them to see that veggies are affordable.
I'm going to splash out and have my 44 cents worth of carrot. Is cost the main reason veggie uptake is still so low?
It's one of the many reasons. So our study has found that just adding nutritional serve pricing can increase average loyalty card shoppers' amount that they purchase per day by 60 grams. And that's an extra 420 grams a week. But there are other factors that can influence our veg purchases. And one of those is time poverty. People think they may not have enough time. Another one is taste. A lot of people think, I can't get them to taste good. And that's why we're so delighted that AusVeg, the national body for vegetable growers in Australia, has endorsed our findings and is sharing them with growers and retailers through their Plus One Serve program, which is about helping Australians eat one more serve of veg per day by 2030. And in that program are lots of quick hacks: how to make veggies tasty, how to store them in your fridge better so that they don't go off, how to help kids eat veg, because some kids don't really like it.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. The voice you've been hearing is that of Associate Professor Fiona Newton, who led a study looking at IGA Richie's supermarkets, if they changed the pricing from cost per kilo to cost per serve on veggies, people bought more veggies. Great, love it. Hot tip here from Greg. He says, get gout. It motivates you to cut down on red meat and increase your veggies. I don't want to do that. But also with me is Jane Martin. She's the Executive Manager of the Food for Health Alliance. Jane, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks, Tegan.
So we're hearing Fiona's study, one I think of many potential arrows in our quiver if getting people to eat more veg is the goal. How do you see something like what Fiona's done fit into a broader food system?
Yeah, look, I think it's really interesting. It seems so simple, but what a great hack to, you know, manipulate people's perception getting products to look more affordable, and particularly the products that people need to eat a lot more of. So I think that's really interesting how you can increase sales in that way. And we know, as Fiona said, that people feel that healthy foods are more expensive than ultra-processed junk foods, but they're not. Apart from price, convenience is also a really big element of it's a barrier for people, as Fiona said, around preparation and the time that's required to do that. So there's a number of elements at play, but certainly this is a very simple thing that can support people to eat more fruit and veg.
I'm interested, you mentioned ultra-processed food, quote-unquote junk food there. Fiona, I haven't done the numbers myself. I suspect, depending on the ultra-processed food, that if you applied a similar cost per serve label, it would also seem very cheap. Is there a way that this kind of approach could end up being weaponized by big food companies that are pushing the kind of food that you're presumably trying to get people to steer clear of?
That's a really good question. And what we're calling this is nutritional serve pricing. So the ultra processed aren't going to be able to say that there is recommended daily intakes associated with that. And so when we work with Richie's and IGA, it's all around this being used only in situations where there are recommended nutritional guidelines to base this on. And when you take it at that level, it can preserve what we're trying to achieve. What we're trying to do here is to combine price with nutritional guidance information right at the point of decision making, where consumers have to decide if they're going to put this into their trolley or not. And so I think keeping it to nutritional servings, which are linked to recommended daily intake, helps to preserve what we're doing.
Jane?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really good point. We don't need to do any more promotion of processed, packaged, unhealthy foods in the supermarket. That's being done very, very well and is very, very effective. And the majority of what is being bought from supermarkets are those sorts of foods. So we need to shift the dial. There aren't recommended servings for those sorts of unhealthy packaged products high in fat, salt, sugar, energy. And, you know, there's a lot of deep discounting, a lot of promotions happening of those products already, and we want to shift people away and use those same strategies. This unit pricing idea is one, but, you know, we need to see more discounts on these products. We need to see more promotion of these healthier products over and above the unhealthy variety.
How can fruit and veg compete in a marketing sense with the big powerhouses of the ultra-processed food manufacturers?
I think it is really difficult. We need to really look more broadly at the system. How do we create a healthier food supply? How do we incentivize that? You know, food manufacturers are very innovative, but what we have is these highly processed products that are very, very cheap and very, very available. And one of the ways to do that is really to shift the demand. So, you know, this is a small piece of a much bigger puzzle, but, you know, we could do more in settings like hospitals purchasing healthy, sustainable food. We could have, you know, it's really important that settings where children are, such as schools, early childcare, early learning, recreation centres, really push healthier options and diminish the supply and sales of unhealthier foods. And until we really start to shift those incentives and shift demand away from the unhealthy processed products and develop the market and develop the demand for the healthier products, that's when things will really shift. So it's really that food procurement, government funding can be very powerful. And then through innovation and research and development, supporting, you know, that sector and that sort of manufacturing around healthier foods and potentially value adding to fruit and vegetables to make it more convenient and easier for people, that hopefully would bring the price down and increase the demand.
Here on ABC Radio National, you're listening to Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Jane Martin from the Food for Health Alliance and Associate Professor Fiona Newton from Monash University. Tina says, I have a freezer full of single-serve soups. I make four different ones each season. Minestrone has eight veg. Currently making a zucchini, onion and green olive soup. Another person says, shop at the fruit and veggie shop where you can just buy what you need, not a whole packet in plastic. Similarly, Sally says, I'm lucky to be near Asian fruit and veg shops in Marrickville, Campsie and Ashfield. Mm-hmm. They're so much cheaper, fresher and varied. Fiona, I think it really depends a lot on where you live as to what's available to you and how much it costs. You know, if you do live near Asian fruit and veg shops or small grocers or in a growing area, that's amazing. Do you see a trial like what you've done feasibly being able to be rolled out in the big two supermarkets?
Absolutely. It's a low-cost, scalable, practical way for all retailers to help Aussies decide what ones they want to put into their trolley. It's just a fast and easy way to do it. It's a simple change to ticketing prices. We're not saying remove per kilo. We're saying add to that information the cost of the nutritional serve and make it easy for consumers to quickly scan that environment to pick the ones that are going to fit their budget.
You say there would be savings to the healthcare system if we all just ate one more serve of veggies. Can you talk me through this modelling?
Absolutely. So this modelling is from AusVeg, which is part of Hort Innovation. And so what they're saying is that if all of us ate one extra 75-gram serving of veg a day, we would see health cost savings of $1 billion. Now, supply chain benefits from growers through to retailers of around $3 billion. And it's worth noting that 85% of that would go into growers in the regional communities, and that it would also create new jobs. So if you were thinking like that's just one extra 75 gram serving of veg per day for all of us, it's good for us, it supports our growers, and it's going to help that supply chain. And I think that's a really interesting way of thinking how we can help ourselves and the broader community in such a simple way.
There's another text here on the text line that I might see if you have a take on, Jane. One person saying, I think we need to rethink the definition of food. And just because ultra-processed food is edible, it doesn't really have much food or nutritional content. Maybe we need to be naming UPF something other than food. What's your take on that, Jane?
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting. It's very pervasive now in our society. They're just ingredients mixed together. I like that idea. I mean, maybe we could call them frankenfoods or something like that. But I haven't come up with a good word myself. So maybe callers could give us their tips.
Yeah. Tell me what you think ultra-processed foods should be called instead. It's really tricky. There are all sorts of reasons why people choose foods that aren't corely around nutrition. There's cultural reasons, and sometimes they just taste really good. One text says, my producer says it should be called UP slop, as in AI slop, but ultra processed. I don't mind that. And a text saying, I'm surprised there's been no mention of the fact that the widespread use of fast food, ultra processed takeaway and convenience has led to the bastardization of palates. Fresh and nutritious tastes bland to those whose palates have been compromised. Fiona, what do you reckon on that?
I'm not a nutritionist, but it makes common sense to me. The more sugar you eat, the more that you can really crave that. But more importantly, you end up not liking the more bitter taste green veggies. The more salt, the same thing. If it doesn't have salt, it doesn't taste right. So I think that there's some truth in that. And I think that one of the things that needs to be done with vegetables is to think of fast ways that we can add some healthy flavour to it through the use of additional herbs, vinaigrettes, just nice little things that you can do to a salad in summer to get that extra serve of veg.
Jane, I'm conscious that this kind of conversation can veer a little snobby sometimes. And just to bring it back to what's going to be actually easy for people, the path of least resistance, that people aren't bad for choosing things that aren't optimally nutritious for them. What sort of framework should we be bringing to conversations like this?
Yeah, look, I think it's really important that we look to that broader societal influence and what can be done to change it. And this conversation around price promotions, for example, in supermarkets is part of a feasibility study that the government's doing, looking at options to limit unhealthy food marketing to children. And it's sort of nested within a whole range of elements. And this is just one part of what's driving demand for these unhealthy products and leading to unhealthy diets and overweight and obesity and chronic disease. So, you know, that's one thing. We need a holistic approach. We need to put a health levy on sugary drinks to incentivize manufacturers to reduce the amount of sugar and put more low, no sugar products on the market. We need to ensure that schools are full of healthier foods and that you're not having soft drinks, lollies, processed foods in those settings. We need to start from early ages to improve the foods you can buy in supermarkets for babies and toddlers, and that's in train. We need to make the Health Star rating mandatory, which is we're moving towards. So they're all some of the regulatory things that have been done. They've been done in other countries, and they have shown that people have shifted their diets, but you do need to take a comprehensive approach. And then added into that, social marketing. So education campaigns layered over these regulatory frameworks that will support people, that will change the environment in the same way that we have done with tobacco control. You know, it was price, promotion, availability, and then these hard-hitting every cigarette doing you damage campaigns that really started to shift the dial. And we need to move to that sort of action.
On the text line, people sharing their tips on what they do to keep their veggie costs low. Will says people should try growing their own veggies. I saved about 250 $8 over the year just growing kale. Organically homegrown food is also fresher and more nutrient dense. Give it a go. Other end of the spectrum, Jen in Coburg says, interesting to see what the price per serve of fresh stacks up against frozen. Frozen veggies sometimes lack the crunch and appeal of fresh. For convenience, they can't be beaten, and I use them when I'm time-pressed. There is an extremely small change in nutrition between fresh and frozen. Well, Fiona, if people are feeling a little overwhelmed by all the tips and information we've given them today, what's one thing from your research that people could do today to make it easier?
Scan that food, fresh food environment, and just think about an extra serve of carrots and think about putting that with some hummus and having a snack in the afternoon instead of those ultra-processed foods. It would just a simple way to get another serve of veg. If you're buying that rotisserie chicken, add a good cup of salad mix. It's just an extra serve, and I'd really encourage listeners to think about how you could nudge yourself towards one extra serve, help yourself and help the growers.
Fiona, Jane, thank you both so much for sharing your wisdom today. Associate Professor Fiona Newton is a researcher at Monash Business School and looks at consumer psychology. Jane Martin is Executive Manager of the Food for Health Alliance, and I'm also very much enjoying your suggestions on rebranding ultra-processed food. One person suggests synthetic calories, one says ultra-processed edibles, or another ultra-processed consumables. Well, maybe you should all consider careers in marketing. Up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, when your friends cancel plans with you, are you secretly happy about it?
New from ABC Books. The young mother arrived at Port Adelaide in 1844.
In the trunk were European grapevine cuttings that she planted.
Her story is the story of the Australian wine industry itself.
Winemaking in Australia had been dominated by men ever since vines arrived with the first fleet, but Mary Penfold had broken the mould.
Mary Penfold by best-selling author Grant Lee Keyser. Book and audiobook available in bookshops and online.
So, you've got dinner plans with your group of friends, you've been looking forward to it for a couple of weeks because, honestly, how hard is it to find time to catch up with your mates? But then, a day or so, or even a couple of hours before the catch-up, you're getting texts. Sorry, I can't make it. Sorry, work's been insane this week. Sorry, sorry, sorry. Some people feel annoyed. Some people feel relieved. Sometimes I'm one of those people. I love an unexpected night to myself. Maybe you're the one who's the canceller. My question today is, are we flakier than we used to be? Our resident sociologists reckon so, but with me is Professor Dan Woodman. He joins me fortnightly. We call our regular chats social studies. Dan, I'm so glad you showed up and didn't flake on me at the last minute.
Morning, Tegan. I thought that might be a good prank to bump me from the show today.
Stop feeling up to it.
Just like you. Look, I love my Life Matters spot, but if it didn't happen, I'd probably turn on Netflix, or even better, just listen to some of the episodes on ABC Listen and enjoy the quiet time. But it's definitely something. I think we all have those moments of thinking, oh, that's not too bad, and probably other moments where we're disappointed that, you know, something we were looking forward to is now off, and particularly if we were the ones doing all that work to get the group together.
Yeah. Is this something that's happening more often than it used to, or is it just kind of vibes and memes?
It's a little bit of both. So people point out that we just seem burnt out and exhausted. Social media means we have other ways to connect. Maybe our skills of face-to-face socializing have diminished a little bit following COVID and all these kind of things, and a cultural shift that it's just more okay to cancel now. But saying that, there's been concern that we're getting together less often or being more flaky, that goes back in social sciences to the 1990s, where people started to pick up that we were less likely to join groups, you know, political parties, sport leagues, other things, and also less likely to turn up when we were members.
In the 90s, that was already a trend.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go further back then. What did we used to be like?
Well, that's it. If we go back to the 60s and 70s, a lot of our social life was maybe planned for us or just unfolded without the organisational work that goes on now. So it wasn't that long ago. In the 1990s in Victoria, I think slightly different dates around the country, but shops weren't open on Sundays. And it was even the late 80s that you're allowed to have the shops open on Saturday afternoons in Australia. You'd have football happened at the same time on Saturday afternoon, every single game. Half the country went to church on Sunday morning at the same time. And in between that, maybe there was dinner at mum's place every Saturday. So more and more of our social life has kind of shifted away from these routines to things that we fit together amongst people's increasingly variable, messy lives. And that means organisation goes on. But also maybe it means that getting people together and them having the energy and being up for it also has become a little bit harder.
Are we really... We talk a lot on Life Matters about burnout and feeling overwhelmed and that sort of thing. But sometimes when I think about how convenient our lives are today, I can't really believe that we are possibly more burnt out than we were when we were all like doing our laundry by hand or like fetching water from a well.
That doesn't sound so good, does it? And like, so with some colleagues, we have this big study where we've tracked different generations of young people. And one of the things we've noticed is that it's not so much that the people's lives are harder, it's that there is this more variability in our lives. It means that we've got to synchronize for time together, but also the kind of the energy and emotional flows of our life are more variable too. So we're talking to people who said, you know, all my friends work different hours. Now that we do have the 24/7 economy, people mix caring, studying, work, all kinds of things. So you might be able to get the group together on a Friday night or Saturday afternoon for going to that sports event. But someone might be rushing off to do some other task at the end. Someone might be going to work or getting ready for an early shift the next day. Mm-hmm. So it means that the people might be feeling burnout at that point in the week in a way that's a different time to everyone else just because of how we live our lives now.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Professor Dan Woodman on Social Studies, your fortnightly fave. One person says, I can't be bothered socialising. There's also a loneliness epidemic. Gee, I wonder if it's related. People don't know what's good for them. Another says, I always say the only thing better than having plans is cancelled plans. All the fun of looking forward to something and none of the effort of actually going. A third person says, bailing is my pet hate. I work so hard to make sure that I never bail. It's the worst thing when you organise something and everyone bails. Dan, is the fact that we've all got mobile phones maybe a contributing factor here? Like, it's so easy to bail now.
Absolutely. So I play on a basketball team every Wednesday night, or I try to get there every Wednesday night. But we organise the games on WhatsApp now. And if we were 20 years ago and you couldn't play for some reason, you'd have to catch the team captain or someone at home on the landline and say, I can't come. And now people are like, oh, sorry, I'm stuck at work. You know, I can't make it. Hopefully you can find someone else. So I should give a shout out to James and Derek who wrangle us together every week to make sure we get a team out on the court. Yeah, we absolutely... Like we can cancel at the last minute, and I think we live lives where that's become more expected. People feel like they can maybe ask us to do things at the last minute too. So social media has kind of made organizing our social lives easier in one sense, that we have this instant connection. But the flip side of that is it also means people can pull out at the last moment.
I'm also thinking about the words we use to describe things as well. Like, we talked about burnout already, self-care, prioritising that sort of time. Is this us maybe recognising more when we do need downtime, or is it just excuses, weaponized therapy speak as a way of getting out of doing stuff?
that line about when the worst person you know learns therapy speak. Again, I think it's a mix. We've recognized that sometimes we just don't have the energy for things. But when it's kind of put into this individualized culture, it means that there is I guess, more energy being drained from someone else, you know, the one who's trying to organise the event. And then there's sometimes, that's the other thing in our research, we've found that sometimes in friendship groups and then later on when our participants were more likely to be partnered, in the heterosexual couples, it was often the woman who took a larger bulk of that work of scheduling life and get-togethers. So our self-care can also be extra work for someone else when we're changing the plans at the last moment.
Yeah, that idea of scheduling being work, because it is work, coordinating and wrangling and coming up with plans and making sure that, you know, maybe you need to have a babysitter or that you've got the food in the fridge to serve to your friends when they come. Was it perhaps simpler? Oh, gosh, I don't want to romanticise the olden days too much, but your whole research, Dan, is looking back across generations. Mm. Do we have higher expectations on ourselves now than we used to, maybe?
So back when everything was closed on Sundays and we might go for Sunday lunch at Mum's place, it was a lot of work for Mum, I would say. And there's probably a lot of mums out there that are quite happy we can go to the restaurant now in a way we didn't used to. So it's not the case that there weren't people doing lots of work to make things happen in the past. I guess there was just that one element taken out of it, which was that you didn't have to have the shared calendar app and WhatsApp group on everyone's phones to actually make the get-together happen.
We do need companionship. The text I read out before talked about the loneliness epidemic. What do we do here? How do we foster this in our own families and friendship groups? It is, catching up together is something important and is worth prioritising.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for recognising that some people are taking up that organising work more than others and sharing the burden. And also maybe buy the coffee for the organiser next time you go out for a coffee or a drink. And then like moving beyond the individual, because there is all these things about how our society has changed that just make it more work. We can, in terms of our urban planning and the way we organise society, think about how we can encourage spaces where people can hang out, you know, the fresh food market or the park or the good cafes where maybe you can turn up on a Saturday morning and without organising things, start to build a little bit of a routine where you might see the same folk popping up, coming along to the park with their dog at those times each week. So if we can organise things so there's a little bit less individual work or need to ask to make social life happen, it might be good for all of us.
So you're not going to text Derek and bail on basketball after all?
No, I'll tell them that the Tegan said I had to turn up this week.
Dan, thank you as always for joining me today.
Thanks, Tegan.
Professor Dan Woodman is a sociologist at the University of Melbourne. He joins me fortnightly to talk social studies with me, and we call the chat Social Studies. And I've also really enjoyed reading your texts on our cancel plans culture. Luke in Melbourne says, it's because we have so much more of an ability to cancel and can communicate up to the last second of meeting, so flaking out becomes very accessible. Another says, I come from a European background, so if an arrangement was made, you'd have to be dead if you didn't show. It's manners. Another, the physical and emotional labour of entertaining mostly fell on women, who are much more extended these days. Stick with me on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Well, yesterday on Life Matters, I was very lucky to be joined by Kevin MacLeod, yeah, the grand designs guy, and Tim Ross, comedian, broadcaster, and self-confessed design nerd. They're heading on tour next year. They're talking about good design and inspirational architecture. But I was really moved by their take on how we tackle the housing crisis so many of us are experiencing in Australia. This is just a little bit of what Kevin MacLeod had to say about how we make sure everyone has a place to call home.
Well, I'm not Australian, so I don't want to presume to kind of tell anybody what to do.
I'm anointing you right now here on the radio.
Yeah, you're making me world king.
Yes. Yeah,
I know.
Go on.
So my answer would be very simply, okay, so this is what I'm trying to do in the UK because we've got a really, really similar problem, is I'm trying to get politicians to stop focusing on numbers because numbers are targets that sound great, but which no housing or supply chain industry really has any interest in delivering. If all we did was devote all our energies to delivering really cheap, affordable housing, then what would happen is we get an overflow of supply in the market, the price would crash, and all those businesses would go under. And no developers interested in doing that. What I think we need to focus on is quality. And we've forgotten this. We've forgotten about how it's possible to build really decent, beautiful homes for people and to give them a quality of life. There was something that happened in my country in the 1950s. It was a tiny thing. When local authorities, councils, built social housing for people in rural communities, villages and small towns, they always put the social housing just on the edge of the village. It was walkable, but with the very best view. Mm-hmm. They got the land that had the very best view because the people they were housing deserved it. And we've politically moved to a position where we think that social housing ought to be good enough. And it's a horrible phrase. We should really be devoting the best minds in the business of building and of designing to producing the very best quality of public realm buildings and empowering people and empowering communities. So for me, it's flipping it on its head, really. You know, I think we just have to get rid of probably 30 to 40 years of really poor and quite corrosive thinking.
Tim, do you think that has ever been the case in Australia?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at the first social housing that's still in operation here in this country from 100 years ago, absolutely beautiful and did exactly that because it was the same as all housing that was going up. And when they were, say, in the 1950s and 60s, and they moved some of the people out of the suburbs, in the inner suburbs, say in Sydney, where they thought they were slums, moved people to the suburbs and built really great, super well-designed brick homes for people. And there was no stigma about social housing. It was for everyone, and we've painted ourselves into this terrible corner where we misunderstand who needs it. And so in every capital city in this country, we need social housing or affordable housing for our key workers, for our school teachers, our firemen and women, childcare workers, everyone. Mm. So they're not stuck on public transport or in the car for 3 hours a day. I mean, we actually, weirdly enough, cared more about people 40, 50 years ago than we do today, and this says a lot about where we've come.
It was such a beautiful, huge chat with Kevin McLeod and Tim Ross yesterday here on Life Matters. You can go back and listen to it on the ABC Listen app. Search for Life Matters and make sure you hit that follow button so you never miss an installment. Tim Ross and Kevin McLeod on your app, your listening app, and also coming to Australia on tour next year. Their tour is going to be called Live in Interesting Places or Live in Interesting Places, depending on how you want to interpret the spelling of that word. We also spoke earlier today on the show about vacant lots and vacant homes as part of the way we could tackle the housing crisis. I asked you about your area. One person in Toorak says two huge Victorian houses were demolished in our street 4 years ago. The double block has been sitting there for 4 years and has been sold twice since the original demolition. Tim says the reason some houses are left empty, one experience with a bad tenant is enough to make an owner leave a house empty or Airbnb it. Tenants have all the power and there's little incentive for landlords to risk renting out a house. Tracy says, I could take you around my local area in northern Sydney and show you empty houses which are waiting to be knocked down. I'm interested in whether rebuilds are included in new house statistics. This makes it look like we're building more than we really are. I spoke earlier to our resident sociologist, Dan Woodman, about piking, flaking, cancelling at the last minute, whatever you want to call it. And I asked you how you're feeling about the fact that we seem to be doing it more than we used to. Well, Anne says people are burnt out because life is so costly. Two incomes are needed to pay the rent, get a mortgage, etc. Also, people live on social media, which has replaced a lot of interaction with people. We've lost so much through the tech industry's takeover of how we have to live our lives. I'm very relieved to be old and retired and out of the game. Another text, I used to be a massive piker. Then one of my friends told me it impacted their self-esteem and I started being more thoughtful about it. Now I will show up almost no matter what, but you got to be reasonable. Sometimes it's just not possible for people to show up. people have got to get better at predicting and planning and saying no to start with. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow, Life Matters will be hosted by Beverly Wang, as is the tradition on a Friday. She is going to be joined by Billy Garvey. They're going to be talking about parental guilt. Last time Bev had Billy Garvey on, you absolutely blew up the phone line, so make sure you don't miss tomorrow on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. And I'll be back with you again on Monday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.